My name is Paul Courant. I am 69 years old. Today's date is October 26th, is that right? 2017. We're in the library, the undergraduate library at the University of Michigan. And my relationship to my partner is that we worked together for several years. She was president of the university and I was the provost of the university. And we did this work on the project we'll be talking about today very much together.
I'm Mary Sue Coleman. I'm 74 years old, and today's date is October 27th, 2017. We're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the Shapiro Library, and Paul Courant is my great colleague from the 12 years that I was president of the University of Michigan. So, I want to ask you the first question, Paul. When did you first arrive at Michigan, and what was your impression of the university and the community?
So I first arrived here in the early winter of 1973. It must have been January. I was on the job market as an assistant professor in economics and public policy, and my first impression was that the streets were paved with ice. It was cold. I was living in New Jersey at the time. New Jersey isn't exactly balmy, but it's a different character of weather. And my impression was very much, and it still is after all these years, the people were extraordinarily friendly, much more so than New Jersey.
Well, something must have kept you here because you had your entire illustrative academic career here at the University of Michigan.
Well, it wasn't the weather. It was partly the people. And, of course, it's a great university to do work in, so... It's always been stimulating and fun to be here.
Well, when I first met you was when I interviewed to be president. It really came on campus, I guess, was when I was announced, actually, as president. And you were the provost at the time. And little did I realize at the time that you and I, a few years later, would embark on a project that certainly I felt would transform the world.
I remember actually the day that you came and were announced, and you had figured out the key to talking to people in Michigan, which is to hold up your hand in the form of a mitten and point to the places that you're talking about or have been. And I thought, she's gonna be fine here.
I was doing a quick study because I'd never really been to Michigan before, and so it was a new experience for me. But it turned out to be the sort of highlight of my life, being here as Michigan.
So let's talk about the project. And actually, I'm very curious because I don't remember. I remember how I got started in it, but I don't remember the point at which I brought you into it.
You know, I was trying to recall that, too. I do remember having a conversation with Larry Page at Google, who is an alum of the computer engineering program at Michigan and obviously a brilliant young man as one of the founders of Google. And you know, he made some comment about digitizing all the literature in the entire world. And I thought, oh, 29-year-old, you know, big ambitions. And I didn't think it was even possible. But then Bill Gosling came to tell me about this interest. It was later. And then you and I talked, I think, after Bill had mentioned to me, and I remember I was so skeptical that somebody had to prove to me with the number of scanning stations and the number of people that would be employed and the rate of turning the pages to photograph the pages that we could do 1 million a year, which is what you had to do.
And which we actually, once we the whole thing got rolling, we hit that target relatively easily.
But do you recall that? Do you recall how mind-boggling it was? Because Michigan had been doing digitization for a long time. I mean, we'd done some very interesting projects, and we might want to talk in a minute about the making of America, but that was just fascinating to me. But we were doing 7,000-8,000 books a year.
No, I remember making the calculation when we went public a couple of years later with the project, the calculation, which was not quite accurate but close enough, that it would take us 1,000 years to digitize our current collection. Actually, it would have only taken about 800, but that assumed that we wouldn't buy any more things, which of course we would have. Basically, it would have taken forever.
Yes.
To digitize the collection. And Larry waltzed in here and said, I think I can do it in 6 years.
Yes.
And actually, we pushed on it, and we thought we could. And I think if we had, we didn't quite in the end do the whole project, mm-hmm. but we did 6 million volumes, and we were certainly working at the rate of a million.
Do you remember, it wasn't it in the Burr building that this was a sort of nondescript building over by the Michigan Stadium? That who would know that there are all these stations in there, and people are working 24 hours a day, turning the pages of books, because to digitize, you still had to turn the pages.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nothing happened by magic.
It was a very unmagical process. I had to sign an NDA in order to be able to see it, but I think I'm not breaking any rules at this point. Basically, it was two cameras and an easel, and people would turn the pages, boom, click, boom, click, boom, click. Like that. We started out in the Buhr building. We started out basically there. And then Google, it was a big enough take that I remember our chief financial officer said we ought to really be renting this space rather than giving it to Google.
Mm-hmm.
And Google decided, okay, if we're going to have to pay for rent, we're going to move to some warehouse slightly out of town, which is what they did. But it was a huge operation. Google being Google, designed their own library cart. The library cart is, of course, a library cart is sort of one of the objects that all libraries have, and they're all the same. No. Google designed a special library cart that fit perfectly into the trucks that they were using to move the books into the to the scanning station and then move them back. And they did it. They actually did it just like, just like graduation. Everybody lines up, you follow the person in front of you out, and then you follow the person in front of you back in. So the books they'd clear a whole set of shelves of books, they'd fill up the carts, they'd move the carts in order, the books staying in order, down to the scanning station, they'd scan them in order, and they would then come back the same, and nobody had to think very much about where the books were supposed to go. It was remarkably efficient in process, and they were doing, once we really got started, 30,000 a week.
Don't you remember being so excited about the potential power of the project and the fact that, at least I know that you and I talked about it on occasion, that we would have the power here to open up information to anybody who had an internet connection around the world. And since we'd been engaged, I mean, even back in the 1940s with helping restore libraries that had been destroyed through war in other countries, that for us, it was not only, it was making it accessible, but it was also preserving a treasure that might be destroyed. You remember Katrina, when all those government documents at Tulane were underwater? They were gone.
And partly, actually, because of this project, it was possible to restore other parts, make available to Tulane and other libraries that have had such difficulties, replacement copies of works that they already own. And we had this the holy grail of this thing, the utopian dream, was that all these works would be digitized and available on the web to anybody who wanted to read them. We have the books now. They're on the web, but they're only available under consistent with copyright rules. And so it'd be nice to be able to get to the point where anybody could look at any one of them from anywhere. But at least we have them all, so they're safe. And the ones that are in the public domain, which is about 2.5 million of our works, and then other ones around the world as well, are absolutely open and get read and used for research and for also research about the linguistic content of the words every day. It really, really is transformative. And I think from the very first moment we knew that if our library were digitized, it could be used in a completely different way. Only additive, right? Everything in it gets better if you have it in this form.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that sometimes people forget is that many of the volumes that we have are printed on acid paper. They're going to deteriorate over time. And so we do have this obligation to preserve the knowledge as well. And we thought, well, we'll have a master copy when things do get destroyed. And ultimately, all the copyrighted works will go out of copyright.
Yep.
Maybe a long time, but they will. And if we have them, they can be used in that way. You know, I want to go back a little bit because I was so intrigued by the story that came out of a digitizing project before Google, The Making of America, that the library here at Michigan had done from 1850, I think, to 1870, somewhere in that period when there was so much going on in the country, and the story about the beekeeping book. Now, do you want to tell the story?
You should tell the story about the beekeeping book.
I just this story just blows me away every time I think about it. So back in 1860, there was a book published about the art of beekeeping. And it was in this collection from the corpus from 1850 to 1870. And we just had this feeling, the librarians had a feeling, that if those books were digitized and made available out on the internet, that nothing's in copyright from those, so they could be out anywhere, that that would be something valuable. And we further agreed to, if somebody wanted a copy, that we would download and print it, because we had the capacity to print and bind books in the library. Well, the art of beekeeping has become, hundreds and hundreds of people have requested that book. And before that, nobody knew that it existed. In fact, in that whole archive, I think they're getting millions of hits a year on those volumes, because now people know about them. So we are making available to the world books that aren't in print anymore, and in fact, most books that have been published in the past are not in print.
Yeah, almost all books are not in print, and some of them are lost or in bad condition. The beekeeping book is a bestseller, and I'm told by people who know something about beekeeping that actually what they knew in 1860, whatever, is still what you need to know. And so the book continues to to be a valuable one. I just want to go back a little bit to the story, the very beginning, as I understand it. I think Larry Page was visiting here. He was, as you point out, young.
Yeah.
He's still pretty young. And he was giving a talk at the engineering college.
Mm-hmm.
And the engineering college, of course, viewed him as a potential donor down
sure.
the road. It's actually important to remember, Google in 2002, which is when this first set of conversations happened, was just a medium, small ma-and-pa monopoly. It was Larry and Sergey and a few of their friends. They were doing about $2 billion worth of business a year.
Yeah.
Google of today is in the 60s
right.
of billions of dollars of business. Google today is a much larger,
huge.
more worked out enterprise. But Larry was here and he was giving this talk, and then he asked the dean of the engineering college, who was hopeful about some kind of gift or a pledge,
right.
could I see the university librarian, please?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the right answer when a distinguished mm-hmm. alumnus is in town to whatever question he or she may ask is, sure. So Larry and Bill talked and mm-hmm. floated the project. Then sometime later, Bill came
right.
to me and said, we're very interested in doing this. What do you think? And my first reaction was, God, I think it's fabulous, as long mm-hmm. as it's of high enough quality that we can use the scans. And, you know, Google's actually very skilled, and the methods they worked out were indeed sufficient. And then we spent, there was a long period of quiet.
It was 2 years.
Yeah, really 2 years between when we agreed that this was a good idea and we signed the first cooperative agreement.
Well, you know, right away, we were concerned about the issue of litigation. And I remember having many conversations with the general counsel at the university about this, but also with the Board of Regents, the governing board, about, you know, we didn't want to put the university in a position that it was going to be somehow liable. And so this was a very much a part of the conversation. Now, at the end of the day, we worked out an agreement so that we had indemnification from Google, and so we actually didn't get sued by the Association of American Publishers, but Google did. And I think, unfortunately, I think those all that litigation and all those lawsuits caused them a number of years later to sort of back down from the project. What we did then was to engage with forming the Hadi Trust. And you might want to talk about that a little bit, because I think that's a resource that people still have that's really a very... We were sued there, too, but we won at every stage because of the fair use doctrine.
Yep. So the Hadi Trust is a digital cooperative digital library. The partners are more than 100 libraries around the world. The founding partners were the University of Michigan and Indiana University. When this Google digitization project was going on, the original idea that Google had was they would keep copies of all the scans, and if we wanted to look at them, we'd send them an email, obviously a little more elaborate than that, but we'd basically look, we'd search their records. And we, from the very beginning, said, no, no, that's great. We want our own copy.
Right.
We're an independent public university. We have different values and interests. We want our own copy. We want to be able to use it to allow people with print disabilities to read. We want to use it for these preservation purposes. So you get a copy, obviously, and that's fine. We get a copy, too. And so we started spending, it started to get expensive. We had $500,000 and then $1 million, and then eventually we were going to have 8 million volumes, and we were going to have to store them reliably and in ways that we could search them and retrieve them and so forth. And so we started to build that infrastructure, and then it occurred to us, including very much, I should name John Wilkin, who's now the university librarian at Illinois, and who was then the digital library guru of our library, and was an associate director of the library. So we were digitizing, that Google was digitizing, we were keeping a copy, and then we realized that other libraries were also working with Google, and other libraries were also digitizing for various reasons. And if we all got together and worked on the same infrastructure, we could have a higher quality, more reliable, and secure version. If we each did it alone, they'd be okay, but not nearly as good.
Right.
So we used this collection, largely scanned by Google, to start and continues to be very large. We're now well over 10 million volumes in the Hadi Trust, to start this cooperative digital library. And from the very beginning, we had put into the original memorandum of agreement, the cooperative operating agreement with Google, that we were going to be allowed to use the works in consortial ways in the academic sector. And I think that made all the difference, because we the academy, not just Michigan at all, but 100 universities and more, have this great digital library that is now, you know, moving up towards being, you know, almost everything held in this set of libraries published before the end of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And then those works are, some of them are in copyright still. And the ones that are in copyright still, we follow all the rules, and we just provide snippets of information. We're not making it possible for you to read copyright books online. If you're just anybody, I mean, you have to have special permission to come in as a researcher and use them. So we've been very careful about that. But the value here is all these works that are out of copyright that are available to anybody with an internet connection.
And even the ones that are in copyright, if you go and search, you can find out whether a word or a phrase or a name is in the book. It'll come back in the interface and tell you, yep, page 23, it says Mary Sue Coleman. And so then you know that it's worth taking the trek to the library to look at that book, because it's got the thing that you want in it.
Right.
The other way in which the text can be used is if you want to know when the word gay changed its meaning, you can do searches on all of the uses in the collection of that word and the words adjacent to them over time. So you have I'm just picking one example there, but you have a computationally usable record of essentially all the published words from this period that most
people. You know,
of
and that's
crime.
The kind of research, Paul, that without this, you cannot do.
Cannot do it.
Because you, first of all, you can't get access to the physical copies of the books. You couldn't possibly read them all. So this is just another level of human endeavor and scholarship that I think has been extraordinarily valuable and really, that's what was transformative about it. And, you know, I'm disappointed that the litigation caused Google to back off. I'm very happy with the HathiTrust because I think that's been extraordinarily important. And I'm proud. I am so proud that we did it.
Yeah, it really is. And we involved many other universities, but I have to say, in those early stages, everybody but us was cautious.
Yes.
And we were not cautious. We were, in fact, our lawyer put it very well, and you don't expect lawyers to necessarily be so enthusiastic. He said we were intrepid.
Yes.
And I think that's a very good description.
Well, but you know what? That's what the University of Michigan is. And yep. So many times it has stepped up to the plate and done things that others are hesitant to do. And, you know, I had written about this story that Michigan has believed in the power of books forever. The first gift to the University of Michigan was a German encyclopedia that was brought to the university by a fur trader from Wisconsin shortly after the founding of the university in 1817. And we still have it. You can go read it in the special collections. That says something about Michigan.
You mentioned that we worried about litigation.
Yes.
And we were careful about the, and eventually, of course, we did get sued. We got sued by the Authors Guild, and the suit basically said that the copying, they asserted that the copying itself was a violation of copyright law. My recollection is that we did not expect that suit, that we were somewhat surprised by it. There were some other ones I expected, but what's your recollection?
You know, we were hopeful, I think, that because we believed so much in the project, and we believed that we could follow all the rules and that we were not going to do something that would hurt authors or publishers, And I felt like our arguments were very persuasive. So when they did decide to sue us, I was a little bit shocked because I thought, don't you see this? Don't you see that what we're doing is we are exposing your work to the world and you will benefit? And I just couldn't get my mind around how they would feel threatened.
Yeah. So I have to say here, speaking as a former university librarian and also was an academic author, almost all of the books in university libraries have very little street value. They're technical, they're published for a particular academic audience, they have print runs back in the old days of 500, not 5,000, nowadays even often smaller than that, and they're mostly written by people, by scholars, who want their work to be cited and used. So what you just said about we're not doing anybody any harm here, what we're trying to do is get the word out and get it more usable is exactly the way that we mm-hmm. thought of it. And I believe the way most academic authors think about it. And I'm still hopeful that down the road we will be able to make agreements with publishers and
sure.
authors and maybe some changes in the law around how to handle works where it's not clear who the rights holder is, so-called orphan works. This isn't over yet.
Mm.
And because we have all these scans, they're all extremely valuable, you know, they're all useful. If we could use them more, that would be better. You made that pitch to a meeting of the American Association of University
Publishers.
Mm-hmm. Several years ago. And I recall the warm-up to it. You were putting your head in the lion's den.
Yes.
How did it go?
Well, you know, first of all, I think they were very surprised that I agreed to come and talk. And I think they were loaded for bear when I got there. They were just going to beat me up about it. And I think I persuaded them that we were doing the right thing. It was a very interesting. I didn't get many questions after the speech.
Huh.
But you know, I hearkened back to the history of doing this and why books are so important and why what our goals were and what we were trying to do. So it was a interesting experience for me, I have to say. But I think in the end of the day, the University of Michigan came off okay. That we were not the bad guys here. I don't think so.
Yep.
But, you know, knowing what we know now, Paul, is there anything we could have done differently in the beginning to get a different outcome? Or do you think it was just the forces arrayed against us were such that we could not have made a different outcome?
So I think all the way up through... all the way up through to the Orphan Works project that we tried to implement, and that was quite late in the whole in the whole business. Most of the digitization had been done by then. I don't think I would have changed a thing. Larry comes in and says, we're going to make your collection digital and readable. We negotiate back with him that we'll have our own copy and be able to share it with other scholars around the world. That's pretty good. We cross-indemnify so that we're not responsible legally for any of their uses. They're not responsible legally for any of ours. And we have some protections as a public institution and as a library that Google doesn't have as a for-profit private sector corporation. So that was all good. The work was piling up. I mean, we were pouring out scans at a great rate and enlisting the other academic libraries of the world to join with us. That was all very good. Google got sued, not us, in the first instance, by both the authors and the publishers. And we weren't happy about that, but I actually wasn't surprised. Google's a much better target to sue than we are. They're not a public library. Good heavens, public libraries. Everybody likes libraries. And so all the way up through there, I really think we made the right moves. We then got into, you know, there was this very complicated settlement of the lawsuit, which would have led to Google actually basically turning the whole collection into an online bookstore. And we worked hard with them to try to make that work. It was at that point that things began to become unglued. Lots of academic authors weren't quite so sure they wanted this to happen. There was a lot of concern that Google would have a monopoly over scholarly literature. My own view, again, as someone in the scholarly literature business for a long time, is it's a monopoly over something, you know, that people don't pay very much for.
Right.
But still, there was a lot of concern there and a sense that maybe Google had overreached. But we just got carried along with that. That wasn't actually going to be a problem for us. Then we did something that I thought was brilliant, but got us in the end into some trouble, which was one of the problems, as you know, in copyright is so-called orphan works.
Yes.
So some book that was written in 1934, published by a publisher who's no longer in business, an author who's long since dead, didn't sell very well in the first place, sitting in our library, we scan it. If we want the right to be able to make that copy available to be read, we just don't know who to ask.
Right.
And there are millions of works across the landscape that are like this. So we had this brilliant idea. The brilliant idea was look for books that are plausible candidates for not having an owner that we can find, list them and post the list publicly, very publicly, and say, anybody who thinks they own this book, please tell us, and we'll talk with you. We'll be happy to do that. But if we can't find anybody, it's a book that we bought, so we own a copy. We have a copy in the library. We're absolutely allowed to lend that copy to people. We can make a photocopy of it if for an individual student or faculty member's use, et cetera. So what we want to do is take our digital copy and make it available to exactly the same people who get library cards at the University of Michigan. So basically members of our student body, faculty, and staff. And we thought, I still think, that was going to hurt nobody.
Right.
Those books are already here. We already paid for them. We have certain rights to be able to reuse them. The Authors Guild was freaked out.
Yes.
That we would, without explicit permission, allow a book in our collection to be read online if it might be in copyright. And they sued us over that.
Yes.
And we won that lawsuit. We won it big. It's actually an important lawsuit in copyright history. It opened, it made more powerful the idea of fair use, that the things the university was doing, search, preservation, books for the print disabled, were indeed fair uses under copyright law. But we could have run that project a little tighter and maybe we wouldn't have gotten sued. I don't know.
I don't know either, but, you know, our heart was in the right place.
We were, it's not just, I mean, we've transformed, we've made secure the great university collections of the 20th century. Like to make them more readable, more easy to read, but that they are secure and can be used, at least for some purposes, is an extraordinary accomplishment.
It is an extraordinary accomplishment, and I think this brings me to the thought, do we have a great research library here? What do you think our library is going to be like in 50 years? I mean, are we still going to have books on the shelves? Is this going to be a place where people... walking around the library today, because I was just doing that, and I was sort of struck by how many people are in the library. They're sitting at the carrels. They are socializing. We have a coffee bar down on the first floor. It seems to be a place that's so vibrant. And people are at computer screens too, of course. How do you think about that, Paul? Because you, during your long tenure at Michigan, you had a stint where you actually ran the library, so you know a lot about it.
Yeah, so I think that the book collections in the library 50 years from now will be, compared to the way they are now, relatively small. It'll be the special collections, so books that have a special value as artifacts that require special attention, but also books of many kinds, because it's will still be extremely important for students to understand the long period in which the book was the dominant kind of document for scholarship. I think that we will continue to have librarians and expertise. So one of the things that the digital world makes possible also causes problems. There'll be a collection of some, say, some papyrus in a university in Italy. And somebody here wants to be able to use that collection. But how are they going to find out what the details of the collection are? Not everything carries with it ideal data of the kind that you would want. Well, you actually want to have a librarian who knows a lot about papyrology. Oh, we have one of those. And so when you want to search and use works that are far away in fields of distant expertise, the librarians here now have to be responsible, able to deliver information about collections that are elsewhere, as well as collections here. And I think that function of being able to work through the relevant academic literature and the relevant cultural literature is one that will continue to be performed in, we don't have to call them libraries, in the buildings at the center of the campus where the books used to be, by people who look a lot like librarians, which is to say, people who know very well the content of the various relevant collections around the world.
So it sounds like that you absolutely believe that the scholarly discipline of library science, I mean, just the management of libraries, the preservation of collections, because we do have many fragile items in the library, that this will continue regardless of the degree to which we all become digital and online and have access.
And a handful of the great libraries in the world, and Michigan's one of them, are going to want to have those original copies securely placed someplace in a very, very good climate that preserves paper for a long time. Because in the end, sometimes you're going to want to go back and check the original.
Yes.
And sometimes when you go back and check the original, you discover that that semicolon was really a comma and it makes a difference.
Right.
And so...
the reinterpretation of literature is constantly occurring. And if you don't have the original work, sometimes that isn't so easy. Or, you know, there may be notations in books of certain that hadn't been digitized when they were being annotated or whatever. I mean, these change, I mean, over time. And so I think we need to be cognizant about that.
But I also think libraries will form a function, as they do on many campuses more and more, as central meeting places, as places for group projects, places to have expensive hardware of various kinds, and again, good expertise on how to use works that are both traditional library works, but also quite different. 3D printers, for example. Library is a good place to have your 3D printer.
That's exactly right. Now, I want to ask you one more question, because you spent your whole career here at Michigan, and you're not in the twilight of your career, because you're still really active, Paul.
But the sun and the horizon are not so far away.
So tell me a little bit about, if you reflect back on all those years and what you've seen. We've talked a little bit about Michigan and how intrepid it is. And give me your sense about it.
So it's
the 200th anniversary that we're celebrating.
It's the 200th anniversary, and I think that the university's commitment simultaneously to a sort of public mission that we want people to use our facilities. We treat this library as a public library. People are allowed to come in off the street and read books in the library and go to the computer terminals and such. A public mission that's absolutely true to the ideals of scholarship. So we serve we serve the population as a whole, and we also actually serve our own faculty and students. And our job is to make it easy for them to learn and teach, and then easy for that learning and teaching to go out there into the rest of the world. And the attitude here throughout my career, I would say, anytime I have wanted something from the administration, they have been able to deliver what it was I needed to do my work. And as I moved into administration, I thought, well, that's actually a very good goal for me to have, right? So we should be making this place one in which students, faculty, staff, the broader public, the broader world can do their work well, because we're able to provide the expertise and resources to make that happen. I think that's been a very strong commitment of this place ever since I've been here, that the right answer to a well-posed question is yes, we can do that. We're Michigan. Of course we can do that.
You know, I think that's the hallmark of a great, great university. And I think you've just described something that we should all feel proud about as we celebrate the 200th anniversary. I think we've lived up to our potential, though we all have a long way to go.
We got it. We can do more. Always more.
Always do more.